When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, my name's Jess Phillips, and welcome back to Yours Sincerely. Now, most of you might know I'm an MP in Birmingham, but what you might not know is that I've always been a prolific letter writer and know the power of putting words to paper. So in this podcast, I give my guests a chance to celebrate three people that mean the world to them. Someone they love, someone who's no longer around, and someone who doesn't realise how significant a role they've played in their lives. And when we've heard more about each person, they'll reveal how they would sign off each letter. Kit DeWall is an author and screenwriter who recently published her memoir, Without Warning and Only Sometimes, Scenes from an Unpredictable Childhood. Kit grew up in Birmingham, where she worked in criminal and family law before writing her first novel, My Name is Leon. The book went on to be shortlisted for the British Book Awards, Desmond Elliot Prize, and be adapted into a film for the BBC. Today, I'm excited to talk to her about the letters she would send to three people who mean the world to her. Hello, Kit. How are you in your lovely room?
I'm very good. Thank you, Jess. Very good to see you.
You too. So this is all about letter writing. Now, I'm afraid to say that there is a big, there's a division in the people that I have on this podcast, and that division is age. And the people who are under the age of 30 have literally never written a letter in their lives. And so I'm going to assume that the answer to my question is yes, because I'm going to say, were you much of a letter writer? Are you much of a letter writer?
Back in the day, I was, I was a letter writer anyway. I used to write to my cousin in Australia from the time I was about 11. But I then worked as a secretary. And back in those days, your job was to open the post and it would be, you know, all letters, business letters. And you might have 40 and you'd open them with a paper knife and you'd stamp them to say this is the day they came in. And then you answered them by typing the response. So from the time somebody wrote to you, put it in the post, you got it. That, let's say that's 3 days. Then you got it. You might answer it the next day. They take, so it was a week. Email now is like, bam, instant. It was a week before you got an answer. And you know what? There's something very lovely about that. Because you get time.
Like I've sent
you know,
it
someone's
off.
Not saying, can I have that by the close of play today? You're like, close of play.
Yeah.
It's like close of play was end of the month. You know, it's, I do miss it. And there is something very lovely about getting a handwritten anything like birthday card, Christmas card, but especially a letter. There's nothing like it. Let me just say this. I know I've got a big mouth, but I'll carry on. Mark Twain said when he was writing to his brother, I'm sorry this is a long letter. I didn't have time to write you a short one. And what that means is you put such a lot of thought into a letter when you write a letter. You don't just rattle it off like you do with an email, no thought. You think about it. It's got a different quality to it.
I just think I'm more honest in the medium of pen to paper. And I, not that, you know, you're deeply dishonest when you're writing an email, but there is something of playing a role when you're in the role of a person who's emailing, like you're at work or you're cross about something and you're emailing a complaint or something. Whereas when I sit down, I feel like there's an honesty in, because for me to be doing that, I must really want them to see my hand marks.
Yes.
And I just feel like I'm much more likely to tell the real story if I write it down. So do you have any special letters that you've kept or letters of note from anyone particularly special?
No, I don't think so. No, that's not true. I keep cards from my children, birthday cards from my children, where they've been told to say, I love you, Mum. I don't care why they've said it. I'll still have it because that's, you know, it's as close as I get from them too.
I know. I often wonder about the aunts and uncles who send 20 quid in the post to my kids, if they feel any sincerity in what is written back from my children, because it is just like, thanks for the money, I bought this. And it's just like...
Totally.
They
and you have to, you stand
forced.
Over them.
Yeah.
And you go, write it now and then say thank you and then put two kisses and then you send it off. Everyone knows the kids have been forced into it.
Yeah, but still, it carries some form of sentiment still. I've asked you to have a little think about the people that you would want to celebrate in the medium of letters. And the first person I asked you to think about was the person who means the world to you. So who have you picked to send that particular letter to?
I've picked somebody called Adam Sharp, who's a friend of mine. And I don't know about you, but normally, well, I'm older than you, so I'm 62 now. And I sort of think, I've got my friends. Do you know what I mean? I'm not making any new friends. I've got my friends.
I definitely think that, and I'm only 41.
Exactly. So, but Adam came into my life about 5 or 6 years ago when I wrote an anthology called Common People. And he was one of the people that contributed to it. And he wrote about the beginning of his life. His mother was a heroin addict. His father was a heroin addict as well, but his mother was horrified to find herself pregnant and tried to get rid of him, but she was too far gone to have an abortion, so she did lots of other things. So this 2,000-word memoir was about him writing about that. It was so naked and honest and beautiful, and I thought, I've got to meet this guy, because I didn't meet everybody that contributed to the anthology, but I had to meet him. And we've just become really, really good friends. And that's, like, for me, quite unusual to have a good friend that I haven't known for that long. He is now an author in his own right. He wrote a book called The Correct Order of Biscuits, which is just a book of lists. And the first, the title name comes from the fact that he's ranked biscuits in the correct order. Obviously malted milk at number one. I mean, what can I say?
Obviously. It wouldn't be my choice, but I can see why it's an obvious choice. It's a classic.
It's a classic. And he's also doing a PhD now on heroin babies and how society views people born with addiction and the issues that arise from them. And we spend a lot of time together and we ring each other and swear. We watch trash TV together. First dates. I wouldn't say first dates was trash TV.
I mean, it is, but it's brilliant.
But it's brilliant. Exactly. So we're
it's
always
really
going,
heartwarming, actually, I think. I don't think it gets enough credit for the fact that it's actually really...
It's kind.
Yeah, it's kind. It's not what my dad refers to all TV as at the moment, is like humiliation watch.
Yes.
It's not humiliating. It's sort of gentle. And well, it's kind. So I actually think it deserves more credit than
I do.
Than
I wouldn't
that.
Say it's trash yeah. TV. We see each other probably only 2 or 3 times a year, but it's like intense. We catch up on all our dating woes, on our, you know, what's wrong with the world, politics. We swear a lot. I do. I've got foul language. So we swear a lot. It's just great. I love him. It's great.
Oh, I mean, it's a fascinating topic, the heroin babies thing, and it definitely needs more research into it and the experience of... There's very, very little, actually, that has been done over the years around, children born, like, and in utero, the difficulty being there, so children born of rape. There is very, very yes. little research of into... or support for children born of rape, certainly children born with addiction, is another thing I can't think of a specific service for people in their adulthood. And yeah, so there is definitely a need to look into those things. So all power to his elbow. And I'm glad that even through some of that trauma, he was able to, you know, categorise biscuits.
As a very important thing. On Twitter, he's got about 40,000 followers. He's called The List Guy, and he does these really weird list, which is absolutely hilarious. He's got a second book coming out soon. But on the subject of children born with substance abuse, a lot of the research comes out of America, and it's in onto crack, which is similar, not the same. I've got two adopted children. One was born with substance abuse in utero, and I worked in adoption, and for many, many years, and we used to have children who were born of rape that no one would adopt. Now, got to do with anything, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's a major factor. If you have to tell prospective adopters, and prospective adopters are very, I don't know. This is a baby. This is a baby born of rape, and it has a massive effect on that child's chances of adoption. Factor in any substance abuse. And of course, what happens is if you are a woman taking heroin or crack or coke and you're pregnant and you think, oh my goodness, I do want to look after my baby, and you reduce your intake of drugs, what happens then is you drink alcohol more to cope. And then you've got children born with fetal alcohol syndrome, which is destructive, if not more destructive.
And also women don't come forward. There's only two places in the entire country for women to go into rehab with their children with them. Two places. That's just not
enough.
That's just totally unacceptable, especially being as most women who are suffering from substance misuse are. It's because of previous trauma and or violence in their own lives. It's deeply unsupportive, actually. And so it's really, really important that people are writing about that sort of thing. Your life in family law is criminal and family law is absolutely fascinating to me. I should admit something to you, that if there was one institution in the world that I could bomb and start again, it would be the family law courts.
Family law courts.
I have to say,
I
am at my wit's end with family law regarding domestic abuse all the time.
Yeah.
It just seems not a system fit for purpose, not transparent, it's frightening. It's an absolutely frightening system.
And there's not enough expertise. I sat in the family law, I was a magistrate for a while and sat in the family law courts. And I think what there needs to be, I had other magistrates say to me things like, really, does that happen? And I'm like, whoa. You know, you should know what happens in a house, in some families, between relationships. There's good training now, but there's not enough expertise around the table when you're considering anything to do with domestic abuse and very difficult, critical family circumstances. And I think people need to understand the complexity and the dynamics that go on behind closed doors, not always what's standing in front of you, but why that might be standing in front of you.
Yeah, it's tricky. It needs masses of reform and masses more. So how would you sign off your letter to Adam? What would you want to say to him?
I would say go forth, because he needs to be doing the work that he's doing, and it's really important. So I'd just say go forth and multiply if you can, and if you can't, just do the work.
I'm constantly telling people not to multiply. I sort of wish sometimes I look at the lives of my friends who didn't multiply and I think, you've got a cracking life. You seem to go on holiday to the Caribbean much more than me.
Or have a line.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Or just like, you know, be the master of your own destiny and only your own destiny. It does seem pretty nice. So the second letter that I asked you to think about is to somebody who's no longer here or no longer with us or no longer with you.
And yeah, so that would be my uncle Mike. And when we were little, we had difficult family circumstances. And Uncle Mike was my dad's cousin. He looked like Baloo from the Jungle Book, this massive bear-like man with sort of bad teeth and a jowly face. He'd never shaved. He wore scruffy clothes. Oh, my God. I loved him. And he would come without warning. I mean, I know that's the title of my book. But anyway, he did. He used to just walk in the door and go, come on. And we'd get in his terrible van that would have been condemned. It was an old VW camper van. And he used it to transport the steel drums for his Caribbean setup, the St. Christopher Steel Band. And we'd get in. It would crash, obviously, nearly on the way. And then when we got to his house, which was, I say house, Bedsit in Small Heath, he would make us carrot juice. We could climb all over him. He'd tell us stories from the West Indies. Oh, my God. I loved him.
Carrot juice?
Oh, West Indian carrot.
Is that a thing that kids want? Carrot juice?
When I say carrot juice. So it's a West Indian thing where you grate carrots, you squeeze out the juice, you add a lot of sugar.
I was going to say.
You know, it's mostly sugar, let's be fair, but it is orange, pale orange. I hated it, actually, but I'd still had it because I was desperate. And he used to make us this sweet nonsense, and then he'd feed us and he'd give us dumplings, Johnny cakes and salt fish. And all the things we couldn't do with my father, climb on him, talk to him, get a hug from him, because he looked so much like my dad, you got it from Uncle Mike. He was this, you know, he was the epitome of the best uncle in the world. Nothing like my father and my mother, because he was just so lackadaisical and so mad. Not mad, what's the word? Loose. He was loose. He was blue. He was just this big, fat, wonderful breath of fresh air in a childhood really quite bereft of celebration and fun. He rocks up and you'd go, the world is okay. Uncle Mike exists.
Now, obviously, I'm about to wildly stereotype now, although I feel I can do this because as the representative of Small Heath and also having come from exactly where you come from, the idea that the Irish community and the West Indian community in Birmingham, of which you are from both, is not like, I mean, it's full of celebration, but at home it didn't, you know, your Irish mother and West Indian father weren't the lively
ones. What you have
ones.
To factor into that scenario is my mother becoming a Jehovah's Witness.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
So the killjoy of religions, it has to be said. If there is joy in the world, that is a religion that will squash it. So we grew up with no birthdays, no Christmas, bonfire night, Valentine's Day, St. Swithin's Day, Pancake Day. You couldn't have it.
How come she became a Jehovah's Witness as an Irish person? That seems unusual.
She was quite devout, but she felt in disgrace because she'd had these three children out of wedlock. She was she wanted forgiveness. And then somebody, really lovely woman actually called Stella, knocked the front door and said, God's going to forgive you and you can live forever. And she was like ready to sign up within an hour. And that was it for us. Christmas is over, birthday is over, fun over. You're going to die at Armageddon, which was 1975, by the way, apparently. So all of that fun that we'd had up until then, up until I was six, which I sort of remember, disappeared. And we became the joyless family. I mean, we obviously took the piss out of everyone. So we had quite a lot of fun under the radar, but there were no celebrations. So Uncle Mike coming was like Christmas. It was like our Christmas. He was wonderful.
I mean, it's nice to know that when they're door knocking, somebody does change. They must be doing it for a reason. And I'm glad to hear that somebody's door they knocked actually did convert.
Because
as somebody who knocks doors regularly to talk to people about their voting intentions, I'm quite glad that they aren't knocking. I often think, does anyone say, oh, yeah, I'll become a Jehovah's Witness? But now I have
no,
a story.
No, they really
to...
do. And also, we grew up, so the congregation I was in was mostly Greek.
Oh, really?
So there were mostly Cypriot Greeks, I would say. Then there were some black families and some white families, but I'd say half were Greek.
Sort of mid-aged to elderly black ladies walking up and down my street are the ones I come across. And when I worked in a women's refuge, we had a woman called Velma who was a Jehovah's Witness, and it was brilliant because she'd always do the Christmas shift in refuge. It's just like, yes, Velma.
That was my mom. She, you know, she was a nursing auxiliary at Dudley Road. And she would get any unpopular shift for a celebration. My mom's there.
Yeah, I can imagine why that might have made for, especially when you come from this rich vein of celebration and cultural background in basically the party centre of Birmingham. You know,
exactly.
It must Mind have you, been
I mean,
difficult.
We all, as we got to 16, we all of us, you know, just like, see ya. You know, we were off to live our lives. We knew what we were missing. And you left home, you either were a Jehovah's Witness or you left home. So I left home when I was 16, as we all did, more or less. And then it was sex, drugs and rock and roll in Moseley Village.
Yeah,
you know, it was like trying to make up for everything that we had lost. I had my 21st birthday party. It was 3 days long. I was like, let's go.
That sounds like Moseley Village to me. Funnily enough, I met my, well, I didn't meet him. I'd known him before, but we started going out in the Bull's Head in Moseley, me and my husband. He worked there and I worked there as well. But also his parents met in the Bull's Head in the 1970s. And that's where they'd met. So the Bull's Head in Moseley Village is a place for happy long-term relationships to start. So,
oh, I better go and see. Yeah,
get yourself it down the Bull's Head in Moseley, which is now called the Cuban Embassy. But it's still very much the Bull's Head. So Uncle Mike, and he wasn't your uncle, he was your dad's cousin.
He's my dad's cousin,
but
yeah.
Because he's older than you, you call everybody uncle.
Yes.
Even, I mean, literally the man who borrows your dad's ladders is your
Absolutely.
Uncle.
Absolutely, the woman next door, Auntie Marg.
Yeah, everybody is your auntie and uncle. My children don't even call their actual aunties and uncles auntie and uncle. And I am like, apart from my auntie and uncle, my actual ones, they do refer to them as that, because I just don't think I could have them referred to without them saying the term auntie and uncle.
No.
It's just be so rude.
So rude. For a certain generation, I think you would say it. My son doesn't even call me mom.
No,
He'll
my
say
son
to me,
doesn't.
Mandy, where's the dinner? Yeah. You know, and I'd be like, wow.
My son claimed that I didn't listen to him when he used the term mom, and so he refers to me as Jess Phillips, MP for Birmingham Yardley. Jess Phillips, MP for Birmingham
I
Yardley.
Love it.
When is dinner ready? I'm like that.
Yeah, Luke would say for a long time he called me CommanderMom.com. I'm not quite sure what. I think it might be something to do with how strict I was.
You let them have birthdays. They don't know they're born.
Oh, they have birthdays. My children have birthdays and half birthdays. I've got to make up for mine. So they have the big birthday, obviously, on the day. And then 6 months into the year, they have a half birthday.
I mean, that's
they're never
going
to lose out. Obviously, I'm trying to make up for my own terrible. I mean, it doesn't take a psychiatrist to know that I'm trying to make up for something else. But they love it, obviously. They get two bites of the cherry.
So Uncle Mike, what became of him?
He died about 15, 16 years ago. In the West Indies. He made it back to the West Indies. He went back to St. Kitts to live and died out there.
Most of the West Indian people that I grew up with, their families were first, their mums and dads were first generation. And, you know, there was always this sense that people would go back. I like to hear the stories that when people like went back. I mean, because I think I would rather grow old in St. Kitts.
Oh.
I've never actually been to St. Kitts,
no.
So maybe I wouldn't. Maybe I'm destined to Moseley for the rest of my life. But, you know, this is a nice idea that people...
Totally. My
we're
dad,
always planning to go back. We're always planning.
My dad back. Would never have called Birmingham home. He never did call Birmingham home. He'd say, if he said, I'm going home, he meant to the West Indies. And Springfield Road was where he lived, but it was never home to him. And he died before he could get home. So he never got to go home. Whereas Uncle Mike went when he was relatively well and, you know, enjoyed his time back home. My dad really was too ill to go back.
So, Monk, I love the idea that Big Fat Uncle Mike in a bedsit in Small Heath is where your happy childhood memories are.
Really, really happy memories. So warm. I mean, I owe that man some thanks. I really do.
So what would you say to him in signing off a letter to Uncle Mike?
I would say, thank you, Baloo, is what I'd say. He's absolutely a ray of sunshine in a miserable time, I think.
Yeah, good old Uncle Mike. The good people of Small Heath. I mean, I love Small Heath. And I think that everybody whose family are from Birmingham in a sort of bygone era, everybody's family moves through Small Heath. It's funny, like the sort of the immigrant journey that you take in, and I'm sure it's the same in all big cities with large immigrant populations. I always consider it that everybody's just moving up the Stratford Road,
yes.
Trying to basically make it to Solihull. It's like everybody slowly but surely. It's like, Solihull.
Solihull.
It must be absolutely the same in every big city, but we just happen to know about that one. But yeah, it's. I'm glad that Uncle Mike made it all the way back to St Kitts. We'll be back for the final letter after a short break.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So the final letter I asked you to think about writing was to somebody who wouldn't know what an effect they'd had on you, somebody who would be, you know, surprised to hear it. So who would that be?
That would be Sally Wainwright.
Oh, that's a great shout.
Who, you know, just in case people don't know, she's a screenwriter. She started writing for soaps. I think she wrote for The Archers and Coronation Street. And she is the writer and creator of things like Happy Valley, Scott and Bailey, Last Tango in Halifax. She is a force for good. I mean, when I say good, her portrayal of real people and working class families, nobody does it like she does. And it's because, I mean, I don't even know what her background is. I know she went to university. I'm not saying she wasn't working class, but I know she went to university. I assume she was working class. She was from Huddersfield. But she gets it right. She writes women that are strong women without being fake strong. You know, you don't have to have a power suit on to write a strong woman. She writes real women who are inevitably strong women. She writes stories that we can relate to, normal people. She also wrote a very good, I think it was a two-hour film about the Brontes, which is from the area she lives in. And it was showing the Brontes not as some, you know, Downton Abbey period drama, which makes me gag, but it was a normal house, quite cold. You know, it had that feel that this is how they really lived. It wasn't Technicolor ball gowns. It was really...
Well, it would have been freezing.
Freezing cold.
In the north of England, in a house without... In a massive house without heating.
Absolutely.
I mean, and it's what the country's currently suffering right now, and they didn't have a big Odie to throw
out. No, and also...
With unicorns
they,
on it.
You know, we think of them as being quite middle class, and of course they were middle class, they weren't poor. But, you know... They had sort of no carpet on the floor and, they, you know, really quite cramped circumstances. And anyway, she filmed it in, I think, the Bronte parsonage. It was brilliant in bringing home to us what those real lives were. And I think that's why I do screenwriting. And I have to say, if it wasn't for Sally Wainwright, I would believe that there was no room for working class stories that don't do a bit of poverty porn. You know, like what you see of working class stories on telly is My Big Fat Whatever, or something about gypsies, something about Benefit Street, sneering, in other words. Like, let's us sit here and let's judge what they wear on their wedding day. Let's sit here and let's judge what they spend their benefits on. Let's sit here and judge.
They're not allowed to be clever.
Not allowed
it
to
really
be clever.
Annoys me that you know that they're not allowed to be clever. When you grow up in a working class background, like, people are really clever and learned and know loads about really esoteric things, and just that never ever ever comes across. It is the reason why I am totally and utterly will forever be committed to the writing of Sue Townsend.
Yes,
is because the, you know, this was like a family that were allowed to be clever and political and working,
yes,
class. I was like that. Oh God, look, like they're talking about politics, and it was, and they knew what they were talking about, and they weren't grotesque, but they weren't perfect.
Absolutely.
It's just really rare. It's really, really rare.
It's really rare. And for me, she is proof that there's an audience for those stories. Now, those stories don't get on telly very often. They really don't get on telly very often, but they do get there. Largely, I would say, because of people like her that have done some great, you know, spent a long time. She's not a young woman. She spent a long time in the background. She's really, I'd say, only in the past 10, 15 years got her due of what, you know, for the great work that she does. And look how popular it is. And I think for commissioners everywhere that are commissioning TV programmes, can we have more like that, please? Can we have more working class stories that are good stories and they're not about being working class? They happen to be working class. Let's not fetishize what it is to be working class, but just show 53% of this country is working class.
It's not. There's nothing much to it other than it is life.
Exactly. It's normal. It's, you know, people don't get up in the morning and go, oh, I'm working class, let me get my whippies and my flat cap. They just get on with their life. And yet so much of what we see on television, if it's a working class story, you've got the e-bag gum going on all the time. Or someone was a miner, someone was a docker. That's not the real world.
It's also
it's
very masculine,
and
the idea
I think
of working class. It's very masculine often, and that is problematic.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and where you see working class lives, unfortunately, a lot on television, I talk as someone that's watched Coronation Street all their life, but you get it through the soaps, and there's nothing wrong with that, but that shouldn't be the end of the working class experience on television. Lots of people denigrate the soaps, lots of people slag off the soaps, it's not proper storytelling, whatever. And I think that's where commissioners on TV say, oh, but we've got the soaps. Got EastEnders, we've got that. So all the rest can be the glossy nonsense or the endless fucking remakes of Pride and Prejudice. We must be on number seven. We've got to be on number seven. Can we make something else? Could we make something else? Can we make a working class story? One of the old working class stories that are out there. There's been one Saturday night, Sunday morning, by the way. One. And yet how many Pride and fucking Prejudices are we going to have? Or Emma? Or Sense and Sensibility? Millions they cost.
I saw Sam Mendes talking recently. He's obviously got a new film out, and he said, I have two tasks. One was about something directorial that I didn't really understand about One Shot. And the other thing is, he said, I intend never to tell a story that the audience already knows the end of, so no remakes. And I thought, oh, that's bloody... Thank God.
And, you know, I love Pride and Prejudice's story. I love every, series that's come out, every film that's come out. Yes, I've watched it. There are so many other stories to tell. There really are. But broadcasters want to play it safe. They know people will sign up and sign in for a Jane Austen. There are other books. There are other stories. Please, can we have that? And please, can we have Sally Wainwright doing it?
My introduction to Sally Wainwright was intense. So I'm my very, very closest friend in Parliament is a woman called Holly Lynch, and she is the MP for Halifax, where Happy Valley and Last Tango in Halifax is filmed. Sally Wainwright, maybe, I mean... my idea of Halifax in my head before I went there to help her campaign, because it's quite a marginal seat, is not the Halifax that I arrived in, where the first person I saw had a man bun. I was like, that, ooh, this, well, I wasn't expecting this, Halifax. You've got a bit trendy. It's really quite trendy. And I spoke to Holly about it, and I said, oh, you know, has it changed quite a lot in your lifetime? And she said that the film industry brought to the area by Sally Wainwright has totally and utterly changed the prospects of the place where she lives. So there is, and Holly and Sally are constantly talking about things, and she talks to her about what issues people are facing so that she can make sure it gets included in things like Happy Valley. So like the flooding or the specific issues around immigration, she makes sure that she is actually representing the people of Halifax where it is represented. Holly invited me to the premiere of season 3 of Happy Valley. And I had never watched it before, and I, not wanting to not do my homework, in two nights, I stayed up all night watching the first series and then the second series. I felt like I was a serial killer by the end of it. and it was so intense that I went to see it, that everyone was like, we've waited 7 years for this next episode. And I thought, I've waited 9 minutes. I only just finished it. I literally just finished it. I haven't waited 7 years. But what I would say is, because I watched it all so intently, is and this is rare in any, and I understand why it's rare. The way that people talk to each other in Happy Valley is one of the only reflections of how people actually talk to each other.
Totally.
Yeah, it's like the...
Totally.
Also, they drop things in the kitchen and stuff. Like, I'm like that. Oh, yes.
I'll tell you the other thing that happens in Happy Valley, they lock their car.
Yeah.
You know, like... In, you know, any other thing, they get the parking space right outside the shop and they get out, they slam the door, they stroll in, the car's still there when they get back. And you're like, no, that wouldn't happen. And she got out of the car the other day and she actually, I'm not saying formal, but, you know, took her time and not with a bleep, because it wasn't a posh car. It was key in, turn. And I was like, yes, thank you. Yeah. It's real.
There's a moment where she drops a tea towel and they sort of like... You know, they just
carry
like, just carry on. And I was like that, oh, my God. You don't notice that it isn't there until it is there. And you think, oh, my
totally.
God, what a total rarity. That and the way they talk to each other, the way they have phone calls between her and her sister, where they're not really saying anything.
No.
It's not moving the story forward even.
No.
It's just like they're just talking on the phone. I think, oh, my God, it's brave to put that dialogue in. Because it's sort of meaningless. But I just think, oh gosh, that's so, it makes me believe it so
totally.
Much more.
Yes. You listen to those, what seem to be quite innocuous conversations that actually are doing something because they're ramping up the tension a lot of the time. So you listen to those conversations and because you believe those characters, you believe they will go on to do what they do. And it's incredibly well done. And, you know, hats off as well to Sarah Lancashire. And
The acting.
Yeah, you know, they're fantastic.
The acting is immaculate, but the words are. And the actors brilliant. Were at the premiere and they did this talking thing afterwards where they get questioned. And they all just were like, Sally's a genius.
Yes.
So, you know,
yes.
like it's...
Yes.
But you're absolutely right. There is that sort of the storytelling. And as somebody who works in the field of violence against women and girls, which lots of the content in yes. Happy Valley focuses on, I don't tend to watch that sort of thing because I like to basically don't want to watch First Dates and Frippery when I'm in my normal life. But that, I have to say, and I'm so keen to pick holes in things. I'm so keen to be like,
too.
Oh, this would never happen. But actually, aside from if only there were actually real police officers that gave quite so much more of themselves, aside yes. from that, I can't find fault with it and it's very irritating. And what I like is she's allowed to be clever. That's the thing that, like, she's yes. allowed to be clever and funny and she uses literary, in a thick accent, she uses, like, literary references.
Yes.
And that is really rare that working class characters are allowed to, you know, cite Dante or...
yes, yes. It's just incredible. I mean, she's... But, you know, also, you know, she didn't, as I say, didn't come to prominence till later in life. And I think for any woman in particular, any screenwriter trying to make it in the industry, it is a breath of fresh air. It's an open door. I'm not saying it's an open door, but the door has been opened by somebody. And you feel she can do it, I can do it. You can see your life on screen or an approximation of your life on screen. You can see this woman being successful, getting her dues, getting the awards, and yet not watering down what she's got to say, not pandering to the gallery, not pandering to middle-class sensibilities and what commissioners think they want, but actually saying, no, this is the authentic life that I know about. That's what I'm going to write about. And it's going to be great, and it is great. So,
yeah, hats off to Sally Wainwright. You're right. I thought it was good. You know, I think it's good, but you're absolutely right. It's the portrayal, the intelligent portrayal of the working classes. So, how would you sign off your letter to Sally?
Right, I've said thank you to Uncle Mike, so I can't say thank you to Sally. I would say never change to Sally. Just say thank you. Never change. I can't say thank you again. You never change. Keep going.
I don't think she is going to change. I was driving to the QE hospital this morning and she was on the radio and somebody was delivering a parcel to her house while she was on the Today programme. She answered the door. So it's a bit like the dropping of the tea towel. That does really happen in real life. Like stuff happens in real life when you're on the Today programme. Sometimes you get
a parcel.
That's life. Well, Kit, it has been just a genuine pleasure. It's always, I especially like it when people who come on are from Birmingham, but, you know, to have had so much of a cultural crossover with you because we are from the very same bit of Birmingham is a total pleasure for me. And it has been lovely to hear about your people. I'd very much like to hang out with all of them. And, you know, I like to think of Uncle Mike with, you know, you and Adam watching First Dates.
With Sally Wainwright
seems a hoot to me.
No, I think so, definitely. I'll bring the carrot juice, Jess.
You bring the carrot juice. We'll get together. I think, you know, this is going to be amazing. It's been a total pleasure, Kit. Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Jess. Loved it.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Yours Sincerely with Jess Phillips. If you want to hear more conversations just like this, make sure you click the follow button now on the app where you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow us on social media. We're at Jess Phillips Pod, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. This has been an Audio Always original.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable.
That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.